Thank you so much. Thanks, everyone, and thanks for inviting me to this wonderful room to take part in this lecture series. I first will apologize because I will read a few excerpts from writing that pertains to this research. Some of it's already published, but partly because the recording would otherwise be me jumping back and forth across issues and trying to fill in the explanations and descriptions as I go, and that might not be so nice for the listeners. But also, it will help to distill some of the examples of what I think feed into a larger question for me, which is how to talk about structural racism and institutional forms of racism in the context of dealing with death in custody cases in Europe at the national level, but also at a regional level. So in terms of national cases, whether they're criminal cases or civil cases, but then the human rights cases at the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. And I won't talk so specifically about all of the legal ins and outs of these jurisdictions, but just rather frame the larger question of how to bring a discussion of structural racism to the legal fora of these different courts and of these different cases. And I'll be talking mainly about these issues through the lens of one particular case that I've been working on, which is the case of the death of a man named Uri Jello. So I'll describe this case as we go along. So first in the talk, I'll discuss race and racism in a general way in Europe. And of course, this is going to be a very broad generalization of what race means in Europe and how it's reflected in certain laws in European jurisdictions, so really, really brief. Then I'll turn to a discussion of the Uri Jello case itself, and in particular highlight the ways in which the activists and families that have been working on the case have tried to bring the discussion of race and racism to the case where there isn't necessarily an overt use of racialization on the part of the defendants. So in this case, the defendant police in his death. But there is a broader question of race and racism in not only the facts of the case, but also the way that the case has been dealt with by the law, including the courts. And then I'll end by discussing a little bit of what I think would be potential next steps for this case, including going to Strasbourg, so the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, and also what we would then think might be some outcomes of that kind of, you know, that kind of approach. So what does it mean to go to Strasbourg? What are we asking for when we ask the court to recognize that there's been a violation of human rights, and in this case, the right to life, so Article 2 of the European Convention on Human Rights. So first, structural racism in Europe. The European level, so when I say that, I mean the European Union, as well as the Council of Europe, which is the body that's responsible for the European Convention on Human Rights and which corresponds with the European Court of Human Rights, are two different jurisdictions. So many of you would know that the European Union has the Court of Justice of the European Union, and they balance concerns that have to do with the four freedoms of the European Union, along with fundamental rights and human rights. So there's one type of analysis that goes on the European Union level. The other jurisdiction, so the Court of Justice of the European Court of Human Rights, looks at human rights as they pertain just to the European Convention on Human Rights. So the additional analysis about the free movement of goods, services, capital, people is not a part of the analysis at the European Court of Human Rights, which generally means that there's a lot more, there's a lot more impetus to go to the European Court of Human Rights with the types of right-to-life violations that these cases bring up, because it's really isolating the right to life as, you know, the main thing that's going to be addressed. But just to kind of give an overview of what the laws are at the European Union and the Council of Europe levels. The European Union has jurisdiction over the member states of the European Union, 28 member states now. Primary treaties include the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union, which has a general non-discrimination provision. So I'm just trying to emphasize the provisions that have a relationship with the regulation of race and or the definition of race and the regulation of racial discrimination. So the main treaty, Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union, has a provision that's a discrimination provision and includes race in its non-discrimination principle. The Charter, the European Charter on Fundamental Rights and Freedoms, has an article, Article 21, which is also includes a non-discrimination provision and frames it as a fundamental right. And then there's secondary legislation. So there are the directives of the European Union. So the relevant directive is the Race Directive from 2000, which is a piece of legislation that articulates what it means to discriminate against another person on the basis of race. The scope is quite broad, so it applies to employment, it applies to goods and services, it applies to education and those types of public goods. And it provides positive obligations. For example, member states of the European Union have to establish a body that is responsible for following up with the enforcement of the race directive. And there are similar directives for other protected grounds in terms of equality. And there are other guidelines and ordinances. So there's a provision in the Common Borders Act that says that immigration and border control agents in member states shouldn't actually be using race as a way to go about enforcing border control. But of course, that's been, there's a margin of interpretation for states to act. And many argue, including one of the European Union's agencies, ECRI, the agency basically broadly on racial discrimination in Europe, argues that some countries, for example, Spain, have tended to use quota systems and targets for certain minority groups. And that's been criticized as using ethnicity in the service of border control. But there are tons of examples where I think these issues at least are relevant ones to raise. But those are just some of the aspects of the legal framework at the European Union level that exist. The European Convention on Human Rights, which articulates a list of human rights that exist at the European Union level, which, if you are more familiar with the British law, is very similar to what's in the Human Rights Act, because the Human Rights Act in the UK was taken more or less from the European Convention on Human Rights. That has a non-discrimination provision in it as well that names race and proxies for race as grounds upon which people shouldn't be discriminated. But that convention, that provision, Article 14 of the convention, applies only in relationship to human rights of the convention, which means that you'd have to first argue that a human right is being violated within the convention other than Article 14, and then argue that Article 14, the non-discrimination provision, is being engaged there so that your right is being violated, and furthermore, there's a discriminatory reason for the violation of those rights. So in the cases that I'm concerned with, it's the right to life is being violated, and furthermore, there's a discriminatory reason why that right is being violated. So there's discrimination in the violation of Article 2 rights. So I'll talk a bit more about that toward the end. But that's the general legal framework that exists at the European level. Then at the national level, there are different sets of laws. And as I mentioned, for both the EU and the Council of Europe, there are margins of appreciation in terms of how member states interpret their obligations under the relevant conventions. So this is an overgeneralization, I think, and it's just trying to give a sense of the differences in legal structures at the national level. The United Kingdom has the Equality Act of 2010, which articulates what racial discrimination means, other forms of discrimination as well, but racial discrimination is the relevant one here. It has the Equality and Human Rights Commission, which is supposed to follow up on issues of discrimination. I'll leave it there. Germany has the German Basic Law, the Grundgesetz, with a provision that covers racial discrimination. It also has the General Law of Equal Treatment. So the basic German law is like the Constitution, whereas the German Law of Equal Treatment is a piece of legislation that resembles, what it means in society, it resembles something like an Equalities Act. However, there have only been a handful of cases that have been brought under the German Law of Equal Treatment for racial discrimination. And part of the reason is that people find it quite difficult to access this provision and have it applied in court. There's also a cap on what people can recover if they sue for racial discrimination. And there's a 2-month statute of limitations, which many argue is very short. But that might not even be the primary reason that people don't bring claims. Having done a lot of research, I personally think it's also because of the understanding that it's going to be difficult to prove the claim in the first place. And there's not a lot of public discussion on the use of the law. And there's a national anti-discrimination office, and there are also state anti-discrimination offices that basically serve to inform people when they think their rights are being violated and to engage with them on a one-to-one basis by appointment and to keep statistics on how many claims are being raised. In France, there's a bit of a different approach to race more generally. And in law, first of all, the French constitutional protections, which did include race as constitutionally named grounds, has been revised, I think it's early this year, to take race out of the constitutional protections as a category that's covered. And part of the reason is it relates to the overall approach of France to race, which is to say that if race is basically a false category, it's a social construct that people are using to harm others, then we're going to criminalize it. So in France, race is a criminalized category, which means that by and large, it's a criminal sanction that applies if you sue for racial discrimination. So an extension of that is removing it as a category from the Constitution symbolically means that it doesn't exist really, so we shouldn't be talking about race as a protected category. So as an outlawed category, a criminally outlawed category, it means that to bring a discrimination claim in France, you have to apply through the Ministry of Labor if it's against an employer, to have them file a kind of a criminal suit against the employer, which is a bit more cumbersome, and it removes the person who's experienced discrimination from the equation. It also, many argue, creates a situation where people aren't really going to raise the issue because it's raising it to the Ministry of Labor is like filing a complaint with an external agency, and that the complaints are generally not followed up on in a way that kind of puts the person's story to the forefront. They might be followed up on with more of an investigation into the policies of the employer. But since it's a criminal sanction, it's a big deal for the Ministry of Labor to really aggressively push an issue with an employer. So for these reasons, it's difficult to see what the relationship is between having the law structured in that way and people actually getting discrimination claims through against employers. And quickly, because these areas aren't areas that I'm super familiar with in terms of my own research, the Netherlands has an equal treatment provision in Article 1 of the Dutch Constitution that covers race explicitly, and there's a Dutch Equal Treatment Act that covers race. And in Spain, the Spanish Constitution also covers race in Article 14 of its Constitution, and there's a law of equal treatment and non-discrimination that exists in Spain. So the law is actually, different from France and closer to Germany, have race as an enumerated ground for bringing lawsuits. And not to repeat anything, but there are different ways in which race is thought about socially and politically in these different places, which has an impact on how they play out in law. So the United Kingdom, race is, I don't want to have overstated this, but used and understood and conceptualized as a social construct, not unproblematically, but it's used in a variety of settings, from, you know, keeping statistics on the use of public services in order to decide on funding, in kind of census-type follow-up forms, so on recruitment and monitoring. And the recruitment and monitoring process is kind of an accepted one in the UK, where there are monitoring forms about all different types of difference. And that corresponds with some of the expectations under the Equalities Act to have at least a sense of what the employers are, what kinds of applicants to certain jobs are getting maybe treated differently or denied places. So monitoring serves to foster the ends of greater equality. So that's the idea of what monitoring is used for. And statistics in this case are disaggregated by race in one way or another. In Germany, the word for race is Rasse, and that has a very strong social connotation, dealing with the history of that term, particularly with regard to the Nazi era. So biological racism, and really, you know, strongly tied linguistically with the idea that this is not a term that has a really strong salience in today's, you know, in today's politics or today's society. But that also means that it's controversial within the legal framework. So there's been a movement to take Rasse out of the German Constitution and to provide a more descriptive term, so racial discrimination, in the Constitution instead. And that has led to, you know, the counter argument that it's symbolically important to deal with the concept as it exists in society, given all of its problems, which has led to another counter argument, is that we don't want to trust lawmakers with a very divisive and difficult to manage concept. But out of all of this come two things, I think. One is the idea in Germany that race, and maybe not all forms of racism, but largely a conceptualization of racism that insists on a term like race, is an imported concept that comes from a U.S. Type of understanding of race and racial difference, and where the law's role is in that. And the second thing that comes out of it is the reluctance to use statistical data to analyze patterns of racial discrimination. So statistics aren't generally kept or disaggregated by race in Germany for a whole variety of things, like educational performance or educational tracking. There's a tracking system where people are put into, at 12, they're put into different educational tracks, or it's suggested that they follow certain educational tracks, or goods and services or anything like this. There are statistics that are kept that that relate to the language spoken at home and different things that some would argue are proxies for racial difference, but not all of those are proxies for racial difference in terms of appearance and in terms of the perception of cultural background, etc. So there's an issue with data that comes out of that, I think. In France, the issue is more acute because, as I mentioned, in France, race is an criminalized category, so data is also strictly forbidden in most settings. So the collection of racial data is an extension of the use of race as a category, and it's criminalized. It can be used with very small exceptions, and independent organizations, so non-governmental organizations, have been collecting data, given that they deal with communities that are making complaints about, let's say, profiling, police profiling. But those things are contentious, because if the data is then promoted publicly, then it looks like there's an overstep and a use of the concept of race. But it's the only way, according to lots of groups, to actually keep track of racial discrimination that's otherwise left to, you know, the Ministry of Labor, for example. And then in the Netherlands, there have been writers who have written about the place of race and the understanding of race in the Netherlands. So two writers in particular, Philomena Essed, who writes about everyday racism and the relationship between everyday forms of racism and institutional and structural forms of racism. And then there's Gloria Becker, who has written a book recently called White Innocence. And she uses the, I would argue, it's a flashpoint issue, which is, I don't know if you've heard of this this character called the Schwarze Piet, Black Pete in the Netherlands, which is a character that supposedly fell down a chimney. That's the later version of this character, but earlier in versions of the character is that the character is actually from Northern Africa and has come to the Netherlands with goblins to take children who are bad. But this character is celebrated during Christmas time, and lots of Dutch people get into blackface. Well, they paint their faces black and with red lips, and they're like they're the Schwarze Piet. But this, you know, that in of itself warrants lots of discussion, but the issue there is that the defense of this character plays itself out in stories about Dutch intentions around being non-racist and all of this, but it's defended to such an extent that it creates this other sphere of thinking about the concept of being innocent, but not wanting to address the potential harm, harm of this character, and making this character kind of a centerpiece within Dutch cultural tradition. So anyway, these things are all going on at the same time while we're trying to figure out how to talk about institutional and structural forms of racism in Europe. And of course, a lot of my work really has been around particular debts and custody. So while there is a big gap between the social discussion and the legal discussion on debts and custody, that gap for those who are at the front lines trying to argue that racism exists in courts, so families and activists, I think they experience that not as a gap, but a continuity of the same discussions. So what they see happening in their activism outside the courtroom is very relevant to what they understand to be the thought process among legal actors and judges in the courtroom. So a couple of other comments to the context, and I've really breezed through this, is the relationship between all of this, meaning racism and structural forms of racism, and colonialism. So there's been a lot of writing and activist work around making those connections really visible, from the decolonized movement within academia all the way through to broader political discussions about coloniality and race, not least of all with writing about the Windrush scandal, whereupon people remembered the comment by Sivanandan that we are here because you were there, the idea that empire really made migration kind of a form to think through issues of race and racism, not only globally, but domestically. And with the Windrush scandal, also the hostile environment policy that was turned into the compliant environment policy, counterterrorism laws relating to the presupposition that we know what suspicion looks like and we know what radicalization looks like, so we should just go find it and report on it. So the prevent policy. And Brexit, and writers who have looked at the notion that Brexit is a bit of a search for the powerful, nostalgic empire that once was. All of these discussions, I think, are wrapped up into broader discussions of race. So that being a big part of the UK context, not least of all because there's a shift to the right across a lot of Europe, politically. In Germany, I think, I could have very well showed the poster of Nigel Farage with a long queue of people in the background saying, we need to close the borders and take our country back, and the European Union is helping people get across to us. That was a similar political take to these posters from the Alternative for Germany, the AfD party, which is currently one of the stronger parties in Germany. I think it's third, it's represented third in the federal parliament in Germany. It has 244 seats out of 1,866 in state parliaments. And they have a very direct message about taking Germany back from foreigners, and in particular from Muslim people. So there have been lots of campaign posters that particularly addressed Islam as a focus of contention. But these two posters, I think, are telling because they reflect not only on the global, but the domestic. So take back the domestic sphere. The first one says, Neue Deutsche machen wir selber. So new Germans, we'll make them ourselves. And the second says, colorful diversity, we have it already. So bunte Vielfalt haben wir schon. And it shows, you know, three visibly white Germans in three different outfits, maybe from three regions of Germany. And part of this is the ongoing messaging about the limits to tolerance and the failure of multiculturalism and all of this, which legitimizes a certain form of othering in terms of the social debates around race quite broadly. German activists have been really keen to counter these things and have been quite successful in some ways, and that should not go unnoticed, particularly when a lot of those activists are also concerned with issues like deaths in custody. So this is a street sign that was changed, and formerly it was a street sign dedicated to someone who had started colonial campaigns and violent campaigns in German-occupied sections of Africa, and it was renamed a few years ago to Mayayim Ufer. And Mayayim was a celebrated Afro-German poet, and she wrote in the 80s and 90s about being black and a woman in Germany. And renaming that street didn't erase the history for those activists, but rather layered a different history on top of it and showed part of a social discussion that was ongoing around the domestic space and recognizing racism and colonialism as a part of what constitutes the domestic space. A short aside, I studied European ethnography in Germany in Berlin on a street that is called Mohrenstraße, which is Street of the Moors. And there has been a long debate because it's an anthropology institute as well. So there's also, I think, internal anxiety about what does it mean to be an anthropology department and be on the street of the Moors? And shouldn't we try to like have a discussion and maybe get the street renamed or have something else come out of that? And a lot of black Germans and a lot of Germans who are allied with that position have protested over the years, and many put two dots over the O, which is so an umlaut on the O to turn it into Carrot Street, so Möhrenstraße instead. So that's one way of, I guess, resisting. So now I'll talk about the case of Uri Jalloh, because this is where I think a lot of these issues then compound into a legal case where the issues aren't articulated, but they're in the background and they're there. So Uri Jalloh, I'll just say, was a man who was applying for asylum, and he was from Sierra Leone. And in 2005, he was detained by police when a few people who were cleaning up the street really early in the morning, about 4 a.m., called the police, and they said, oh, there's this guy, and he's bothering us. He's asking us lots of questions, and he's just bothering us. You should come and get him. And so it turns out he was asking them to use their phone to make a phone call, and he was slightly drunk. And so the police came, and by that time he was sitting on the side of the road and just sitting there by himself. So they came, and the account of the police is that they detained him, and this is in Dessau, in a small city in former East Germany. And they detained him, and by 12 o'clock noon, he was dead. He was burned in his police cell. And what happens between then is a mixture of the, you know, the police testimony, the evidence that exists, and basically our reconstruction of that. But I'll just read a bit, a couple of snippets about the case. And I'll jump back and forth a little bit. The Jallo trials in 2007, so 2 years after the trial started, and 2011 reveal a myriad of mistakes. Police were reported not to have informed the fire department that there was a person in the cell that was ablaze. So firefighters were surprised when they arrived and found a burnt corpse chained to the mattress on the floor. Police testified that they had turned off the smoke alarms that registered the fire, claiming to have assumed that the alarms were faulty. They also claimed to have turned down the two-way radio and missed Jallo's screams for help. There were inconsistencies in the police testimony, including parts of their timeline, and the judge presiding over the initial trial admonished police for their failure to cooperate. In the appellate trial, an officer who witnessed the events on the day invoked her constitutional right not to testify for fear of self-incrimination. Despite the admissions by police officers, the prosecutor did not see it fit to entertain murder or voluntary manslaughter charges. Further mistakes were made in the collection of evidence. The autopsy commissioned by police forensics teams missed injuries on Jallo's body that an independent autopsy found, a broken nose and a burst eardrum, and most recently a cracked rib, but I'll get to that. Forensics footage was erased or not properly recorded, so only a few moments recording of the cell's examination exists, which means a proper determination of the chain of custody of the evidence left behind cannot be established. The debris in the cell was not tested for accelerants during the initial trial, which, because of the half-life of such substances, is a time-sensitive matter. This is ostensibly because the authorities believe Jallo had committed suicide. A lighter was discovered among the debris collected in the cell 3 days into the investigation, and its presence constitutes the only hard evidence that Jallo may have committed suicide. Later tests would reveal, however, that the lighter, which was partially melted, had no fibers from Jallo's clothing or the mattress and none of Jallo's DNA on it. It was simply assumed through the initial trial and the subsequent appeal that this was an unfortunate case of suicide, which the police at worst failed to prevent. In the first trial, police were acquitted, and the retrial found the police guilty of negligence, which resulted in a relatively modest fine of about 10,000 euros. The prosecutorial services are reportedly running a special investigation. It's ended. I'll also tell you about that. But the probe is rife with conflicts of interest, since the prosecutors are essentially embedded between the police and the courts. What seems clear is that if there were no public pressure to scrutinize the details surrounding his death, there would have been little political will to probe beyond the initial 2007 prosecution for negligence. I'll also mention the prosecutor has a lot of power in these particular cases, because in Germany, if you die in police custody or in a policing situation, there actually isn't a right to a civil trial. The right exists, though, for the family to append itself to the main prosecutor's trial as a secondary claimant. And the secondary claimant doesn't actually get the chance to draft the charges. The prosecutor drafts the charges, and the secondary claimant just appends themselves to those charges. That means that although in the Jallo case there was, especially in the appellate trial, quite strong legal representation, the legal representation was basically confined to the negligence charges and couldn't raise any evidence that pointed in the direction of someone other than Jallo killing Jallo, which meant really looking at the timeline to how the police responded to a suicide. So another part of the issue is, okay, we have the circumstances that we have. We have forensics evidence that seems to have gaps in it. So the recording has gaps. The autopsy seemed to have gaps. The lighter, many argued, because it didn't have any remnants of anything inside the cell on it, and given the chain of custody issues, should be called into question. The additional issue is how to raise the issue of racism or race, because there wasn't an overt, you know, attribution to the police testimony that the police said something racist on its face, although there are some things that I'll mention. And there isn't a line of argument that there was overt racism, let's say that. So the issue is how to bring structural racism into the equation, whether that means a statistical analysis of similar cases happening or an analysis that is about how the case was handled. So those things I'll talk about in turn, but first I'll mention some of the things that have been raised during the trial that at least raise the question for those who are involved in the case and for those in the German public who have kind of borne witness to the media around the case since it happened in 2005. In a trial, the omission of evidence or a silence in testimony on an issue can be as damning or exonerating as hard legal evidence. Legally, this is because one is innocent until proven guilty of a crime, at least in Germany and the rest of Europe, and without the appropriate evidence, one cannot be held liable under the standard of negligence. Considering this, it's easy to understand how the activists pushing the Uri Jalloh trial forward could come to experience certain evidentiary omissions and testimonial silences as great a weight as suppressing closer engagement with the events of Uri's death. I describe these omissions and silences as a type of violence. This violence has a legal character, enabling and co-constituting societal violence. Among other various episodes, I discuss three silences and omissions during the course of the trial because they illustrate the repetition of scenes of violence that re-injure, remind, and reinvigorate those involved in pushing the trial forward. The first is a lack of discussion around the medical examiner's racial remarks about Uri Jalloh at the police station. The second is the differences in physical condition noted between the police autopsy and the independent autopsy, which I won't rehash, I've already mentioned. They found additional injuries in the autopsy. And the third is the blank section of the crime scene investigation footage. So the first issue, discussed during the first trial in 2007 in Dessau and carried forward into the second trial in Magdeburg, concerns a remark made by the medical examiner who took a blood sample from Jalloh the night he was detained. When Officer Schubert called the examiner to examine Uri Jalloh, the examiner replied that he's never able to find veins in dark-skinned people. To this remark, Schubert laughed and suggested that he should just bring a special instrument to draw blood. This exchange evidenced the general fact that Jalloh's skin color and heritage became a topic of conversation among the medical examiner and the arresting officer during the examination, and it prompted the black community and others to look for a meaning in this exchange. The racial undertones were familiar, recognizable. What was this special instrument, and why was the matter funny? The impression among black people and activists involved in the trial was that this comment sounded sinister at its worst, latently racist at its most benign. And this did not sound like a statement of overt racial disdain or xenophobia, but it was, for many, informed by fears and fantasies by the white majority. A psychoanalytic reading of the statement might suggest that the doctor's description reveals his preoccupation with racial difference, this guiding sense that black people are so different that they evade his capacity to medically treat them, that their humanity, like veins, was difficult to identify, obscured under dark skin. Racism operates through these types of images and metaphors. Though the doctor may not have meant this consciously, his statement publicly revealed, by way of testimony, to a community already in a defensive posture, exposed the horrors of what he could potentially have meant. This reinforces mistrust and the assumption of racial foul play. After all, Jalloh did die hours later, and what happened in between the exchange and his death is contested and obscured. I also mentioned that when the police were called, it was reported that he was black and an African, and so the police referred to him as the black African. And then when the forensics team arrives on the scene with the video camera to go to the cell downstairs to take video of the footage, the forensics investigator, while he's walking down the stairs before he arrives at the scene, is already saying, "I'm going to the cell where a black African has killed himself." So he's, you know, on video, the investigator is kind of coming to the investigation with this presupposition and with the acknowledgement that we're talking about a particular type of death. and at least knowledge of the racial background. And the other omission, I mentioned the autopsy, but the other omission that I talk about is the courtroom footage that was not available. And part of the relevance of that is during the trial, the person who was filming was testifying at the appellate trial. And he argued that the camera must have gone out because there was a power outage in the station that day, which hadn't been argued on record previously. But not only that, the camera was being held as a mobile camera. It wasn't plugged in at any point. And he would have had to argue that he stopped and plugged it in outside of the cell because there's not a socket in the cell anyway. So that testimony kind of just lingered in the air, and the question was, so what really happened to this footage? So, I mean, my point there is that race and racism are a part of the larger discussion of questioning the integrity of the process, and also a question of why the integrity of the process may have been broken. Of course, that sounds conspiratorial, but at the end of the day, conspiracy is also a category of a claim. I mean, one could make a claim about conspiracy. That's not what the activists have been claiming, though. The activists and the family members have been merely trying to understand and articulate what's happened, keeping racism in the frame as a potential lens for analysis, rather than to eliminate it because it doesn't exist as a legal form of analysis. So the activists have really been pushing this trial forward, and not only in the courtroom, but outside of the courtroom. So part of the issue with not collecting statistics on racial violence or policing violence or even stop and search in Germany is that there isn't a statistical way or statistically agreed upon way to present the idea that race plays a role structurally in society, so that institutional forms of racism in policing exist. And so the activists have been trying to accumulate the stories, not necessarily only for the statistical measure of having a lot of them, but for the qualitative aspects of how these cases are similar. So I'll just read a couple more phrases, and then I'll get to the, for the ending part, the human rights aspects. Highlighting the structural nature of police violence has been a process of excavation. In the case of those working on the Jallo case, this has required committing painful stories of the last decade to institutional memory. The Voice, Die Caravana, and the Initiative of Uri Jallo, alongside regular press releases and articles on their respective websites, have co-published a small yellow booklet called Break the Silence, the fifth edition of which, under the subheading Institutional Racism and Due Process in Germany, highlighted cases of other black and Asian asylum seekers killed by the German police or police in custody or in police custody between 1999 and 2007. So after that, the list has continued. It recounts the deaths of Sudanese-born Ndeye Mariama Sarr, for example, who was shot by police in her own home in Aschaffenburg in 2001. It also recalls the death of Laye Condé, who drowned in Bremen in 2004 when water was forced into his lungs during an administration of a procedure meant to make suspects of drug possession vomit. Recounting these and other deaths in the pamphlet, in addition to archiving the systematic use of fatally excessive force by the police, reopens the wounds of the past decade to expose the body politic to a reckoning that is both deeply painful and potentially profoundly healing. It once again brings the past into the present and describes the present as a place characterized by violence. The stories of individuals in the Yellow Booklet, alongside other stories of black people and people of color killed in Germany in the last two decades, most notably the Turkish and Greek men and women killed by the NSU, the National Socialist Underground, between 2000 and 2007, and I can explain the question and answer more about that case if you'd like, form the discursive landscape for making sense of the ongoing pattern of deaths, including their circumstances, legal issues, and media reports. They're relevant not only as an explanation as to what's happening, institutional and structural forms of racism, but also as an explanation for the relentless activism in bringing these deaths to light. Criticism of these violent episodes has been pitted against institutions and structures rather than individual, independent acts of abuse perpetrated by bad apples. The stories have similarities that make subsequent stories sound hauntingly familiar, and this familiarity perpetually renews the feeling of a need for action. For example, the death of Christy Schwundeck in 2011 echoed back to the death of Mariam Assar 10 years earlier on the basis that police officers fatally shot a black woman in possession of a knife and no prosecution was launched. It also echoed the deaths of Dominique Comadieu and Emra Kara, each fatally shot in possession of a knife. These deaths indicate a pattern of disproportionate violence if one considers that there are ways to disarm people without killing them. Knowing these patterns shapes the expectation of people of color vis-a-vis the police in Germany and indeed across Europe. The stories give names and details to a pattern of violence, offering a technical awareness of the ideas of disproportionate response. And I'll just read one last part. The Uri Jalloh case is very particular in facts. However, in the process of discussing both the episode of violence that led to his death, as well as the legal responses that ensued, activists regularly mention cases that are similar on distinct points. Some of this has to do with the temporal proximity of other cases to the Jalloh issue. For example, the same year in which Jalloh died in police custody in Dessau, Laye Alma Condé was killed in police custody, which means that Condé is mentioned in some of the rallies and demonstrations held to honor the life of Jalloh. And in 2011, the trial of the death of Uri Jalloh was punctuated by two other custodial deaths, Christy Schwundeck, who I mentioned in 2011, and Usman Sey in 2012, who was handcuffed and taken into custody rather than being taken to a hospital where he should have been taken because he was having a mental health episode and then died of cardiac arrest. And so the activists have created a campaign that use similar colors and kind of visual techniques to indicate that there's a pattern of deaths in custody. So that's Uri Jalloh on the left, Christy Schwundeck in the middle, and Usman Sey there on the right. So, yeah, it's just a picture of the trial. The last thing I'll mention about the Uri Jalloh trial in itself is that activists haven't only been trying to raise awareness about the pattern of death in custody outside of the courtroom, they've also been actively pushing forward the limits of evidentiary concerns within the courtroom. So it was really interesting because to learn about this as for me, a researcher, and then later as a trial observer for the Uri Jalloh trial, and now as a member of an independent civilian commission looking into the death of Jalloh, it's been interesting to see how the medical examiners and the state prosecutors and the courts are linked in a certain way so that it's difficult sometimes to get medical examiners to give an independent opinion outside of the context of the court trial because it's seen as quite a hot case. And medical examiners, in our experience, have tended to have a bit of preoccupation getting involved, so they don't really want to get involved, which meant that the family and activists needed to look outside of Germany for some of their expert testimony. So I'll read just two paragraphs. A dead pig wearing a yellow t-shirt and dark trousers was burning in a custom-built shed. Outside, as the light gradually dimmed over the Irish city of Waterford, five of us peeled clementines and watched thin ribbons of smoke waft out from the top of the door frame. The pig, fully clothed and chained to a mattress, was Jalloh's proxy. The process of having to recreate the scene was as humiliating as it was traumatic, particularly because those who knew Jalloh, for those who knew Jalloh. This investigation, however, was necessary. Maxim Smirnov, his goal was to ascertain whether or not Jalloh could have been so thoroughly scorched without the use of fuel or some chemical accelerant. So Maxim Smirnov was a former Belarusian police officer who specializes in fire investigations, and he's based in Ireland. It felt as though these tests, along with the very question of police involvement at all in Jalloh's death, had been banished to a place beyond the German border. These inquiries were only allowed to exist in exile, away from the fears and preoccupations of Germany's post-racial imaginary. As the smoke thinned and the fire died, we opened the shed doors to inspect the scene. We were shaken but convinced. Neither the pig's flesh nor the mattress it had been laid upon resembled Jallow's charred remains. Of course it wouldn't, I thought. A body does not just combust. For legal reasons having to do with the production of evidence, the results of the fire analysis could not be entered directly into evidence in a new trial, but that does not mean that Smirnov's work was shoddy science. In terms of the dimensions and materials of the cell, air circulation, mattress materials, clothing on the body, and alleged heat source, it was fairly accurate as a recreation. The outcome, presented at a press conference, raised doubts as to whether the assumed circumstances of his death were physically possible. And this is a picture of the mattress in Northern Ireland with the pig cadaver on it. You can't see anything. You just see flames at the press conference. And the press conference with this fire test was held in Germany, and it attracted lots of attention, media attention. And it also is credited with getting the prosecutors to open a special investigation. This was after the police were charged with negligence. And the special investigation was to look and see if there's any credit to the idea that it wasn't a suicide. That has ended, and just in two words, the special investigation was closed down. During the process of that, one of the prosecutors in an internal letter wrote that he thought maybe there was third-party involvement or not a suicide. But then the investigation was taken from his office and transferred to a different prosecutor's office and closed down. New evidence commissioned by the family, which was a reading of old CT scans, so computer tomography, X-ray scans, from 2005, but scans that had never been analyzed. They were read and analyzed by a clinic in Frankfurt, and the results of those scans was that the injuries that Jallow sustained happened before he died. So a lot of the argument in court was that, well, these injuries could have happened to a person's dead body in the transport from one place to another. So a broken rib, a broken nose, and a burst eardrum. And now also a broken internal sinus area. I'm not medically trained, but those injuries. And it has been argued that because he didn't have much adrenaline, or neoadrenaline in his system or soot in his lungs, he probably wasn't breathing or awake or alive when the fire happened. So those crucial pieces of evidence have been offered, but the investigation was not reopened. So there's been a new decision to keep the investigation closed despite those pieces of evidence. So that's part of the reason why we have a commission to look into the handling of the trial from beginning to end, which is a civilian-led commission, mostly by lawyers and experts outside of Germany, but with some German experts involved. So the last part, in just the last few minutes, because I think it's the more technical one, it's the one where there's the question, it's what do we actually ask for when we demand human rights, particularly around the right to life, potentially at the European level. So we might have yet now exhausted the local remedies in Germany, so it might be time to go to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. What does that mean? So the right to life, as I explained, is the right not to be killed. And the language is, everyone's right to life shall be protected by law. No one shall be deprived of right to life intentionally, save the execution of a sentence of a court following his conviction of a crime, although the death penalty doesn't exist in Europe. Deprivation of life shall not be regarded as inflicted in contravention of this article when it results from the use of force, which is no more than absolutely necessary, in defense of a person from unlawful violence, in order to effect a lawful arrest, or in an action lawfully taken for the purpose of quelling a riot or insurrection. So those provisions allow for policing-related deaths or legally authorized killings, as I think the UK language is, to take place in the context where there's defense of one person against another or in a policing type situation like those. Some of the case law that's relevant is that safeguards need to be practical and effective. That's the McCann case versus the UK. There's a prohibition on intentional deprivation of life, subject to strict exceptions. And the right to life also applies to near-death situations. I'll mention there's Article 3, which is the right not to be treated inhumanely or tortured, and that's a separate article. So you can raise both of those depending on the case. Then there's the policing death-specific types of cases. So the burden is on the government to provide a plausible explanation as to how the person died. And in the German case of Uri Jalloh, it would be the explanation was he killed himself. We've done an evidentiary analysis, and that's the answer. So that would be the government's response, potentially. And specific techniques that hasten death are understood to violate Article 2. So positional asphyxiation, which is very common as a term in this context, in the UK context. But we also have a different prong of Article 2, which isn't just how the person died, but how the death was investigated. So the obligation to investigate is a separate procedural grounds for a violation of the right to life. Investigation has to be independent, adequate, which means it has to be capable of gathering evidence and determining whether the police behavior was unlawful. Has to be prompt. There should be a four next to promptness. Should be prompt. There has to be able to be public scrutiny, which means procedures and decision-making should be open and transparent in order to ensure accountability. And there has to be victim involvement in at least the complaint. I'll also mention that in Germany, there is no inquest process. There is only the prosecution, and there's a potential special investigation by prosecutors, which is very rare. And there's a parliamentary inquiry process, which isn't a coroner's inquest. It is a parliamentary investigation into the evidence that exists in the case, which is also not very common. I already mentioned Article 14 can work in conjunction with Article 2 in order to argue that there's been a violation of the person's rights for a discriminatory reason or in a discriminatory manner. And that is also an additional line of reasoning. So one has to actually have a mode of reasoning. Three examples that show that this is possible to achieve, but might indicate that it's difficult to achieve for the Jalloh case, are Nakhova versus Bulgaria, which is seen as one of the leading cases in policing and race. But in that case, Roma military workers were shot by military police who were screaming, you gypsies, you damn gypsies, screaming, translated. And that also shows that the background of the men was known to police. And so there was seen to be a violation of Articles 2 and 14. But the violation of Article 14, the discrimination, was not for the actual killing. It was for the failure to follow up on whether there are racist motives. So it just shows that there are different ways that the court will interpret whether those comments by police was itself a form of showing that the murders were happening or the killings were happening with a racial intent or a racial kind of gaze, or whether it's simply that the investigation didn't do enough to follow up. The Bekos versus Greece and the Angelova versus Bulgaria cases are similar in as much as Articles 3 and Article 2 were violated, along with Article 14, but only for the investigation. For the Bekos case, there was a lack of follow-up after there was a policing survey, and the police were seen to have acted in a similarly racist way by 30 testimonies. And the Angelova case was a case where it was dragged out so long that, a killing of a Roma man by a group of teenagers should have been investigated really early on, especially if there was racist intent. It should have been at least interrogated early on, and that it took over 10 years. So it's difficult to bring these types of cases to the ECHR. Takes a long time. Prosecutorial power in Germany and possibly elsewhere in Europe means that you can exhaust local remedies, and it can look very much like there has been an adequate attention given to the details of the case, but there hasn't perhaps been as much family involvement. There hasn't been perhaps a way to introduce evidence that would actually speak to the broader claims being made. And there's a high bar in showing an actual racial, the actual killing having a racial undertone. And perhaps it's easier to show that there's been a lack of attention to race or racism in the investigation. But what do we want from that? What do we want then to show if we can show that the investigation into the racism that potentially is kind of pervading these cases exists? What is the outcome of that? And for some, it means that the investigation or a consistent lack of attention to racism in investigations can be a sign that something needs to change in the domestic sphere. The ECHR would probably not be in a position to give a direct course of action to what countries need to do to remedy that, and there's a big margin of appreciation. But then the question is how activists and families can use a judgment like this to spur, you know, a different approach within their national jurisdictions. So just on the final note on what exists, in the UK, there's a mandatory Article 2 inquest, investigation by the IPOC into misconduct by police, prosecution brought by the Crown Prosecution Service, a civil suit brought by families or those left behind, and a potential inquiry, public inquiry, around certain types of death, like with the Stephen Lawrence death. In France, there's a service inspection held by the Ministry of the Interior, but it's independent of the police, and it can be called by any victim of police violence. I'm not sure how effective this is. There's also an independent commission that can be called through MPs, but again, that's at a parliamentary level. And in Spain, there's, and again, I don't know the Spanish context, so maybe my colleagues might know, there's La Ley Institucional de la Policía Nacional, which has the usual norms restricting lethal violence, like we saw with the language from Article 2. And then there's Article 62 of paragraph 2, which notes that that in cases where policing activity constitutes a crime, the district attorney is not able to determine the nature of the crime. Instead, the relevant judicial authority has to conduct an independent investigation. And I'm not sure what independence in this context could mean. So that's a question that I have to research. While in Germany, as I mentioned, the public prosecutor really has the only power to draft the charges that go forward. And the family is given a role as the secondary claimant, the Nebenkläger. But this role, I mean, maybe to put it controversially, maybe that's a way of allowing them to have just enough input not to make a big impact on the direction of the case. So it's not a full civil It's not the ability to bring a full civil case where they could at least ask broader questions. And given that there's no inquest, the only real avenue for the activists and family members outside of a, you know, special prosecutorial investigation is to take matters into their own hands, create the evidence, the persuasive arguments, bring the media into it, and get a forum set up that resembles kind of the evidentiary fora of the law, but brings the law into the discussion in a public forum. So that's what's been essentially happening. And lastly, they've set up this commission, of which I'm a part, to try to get experts from different other areas to give comparative input, but not only in law, in activism. So there are activists who are a part of the commission, and in academic input, so sociologists, and those of us who are looking at the law, but from a bit of more academic standpoint, to look at broader issues, not simply the facts of the case forward, but looking at the broader context of how it is that the institutions aren't able to deal with the claims about structural racism within legal institutions, and how to potentially make it a broader discussion and take it outside of a legal forum. So I guess I'll stop there. I think I'm over time.
Thank you very much.